Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today I'm talking to filmmaker Ryan Bean. Hey, Ryan.
Hi.
I didn't warn you that I would pull you in early, but I always try to pull
you
in early.
I was like, go now.
Right? Because that way, it doesn't sound like I'm doing a big old monologue to your face. So Ryan and I are on FaceTime, and we're recording just our audio. So if audio sucks, don't blame us. Blame the Apple Corporation. Now, this is the COVID world podcast, are no longer two mics in one room. But I'm talking to Ryan because his film, Those People, was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival last year in 2021. And it's a fantastic film. It took home the Programmer's Prize. So I'm talking to award-winning filmmaker Ryan Bean, whose film, Those People, I just think is excellent. So we're going to find out all about it. Before we jump into the interview, I'm going to mention the Discover Indie Film podcast has a companion TV series on Amazon Prime Video that I believe we're going to have those people involved in the future, which is exciting for me. And you can learn all about it at discoveryindiefilm.com, or you just go to Amazon Prime Video, Amazon Prime Video, and search for Discover Indie Film. And currently there are four seasons. Every season is 10 episodes of short films that are handpicked from the festival circuit. It's kind of like the best of the best. And enjoy. And I'm happy to say that Ryan's film is going to be a part of that sometime in 2022. I'm actually saying the year's right, which is not easy because we are recording this the first week of January. So I kind of don't know what year it is.
Yeah, I've already said 2021 like 15 times. So
it's tricky, right? It's so tricky. All right. Well, here, Ryan, I always jump in. And the first question is always just, what were your inspirations to get into filmmaking? It sounds like you wrote and directed, probably did almost everything involved in this film.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote, directed, and edited.
And edited and produced, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a whole lot of work for you. So what were your early inspirations? Were you an AV kid? Did you play with video cameras? Were you just totally a fan of the medium?
I actually was not really into the whole like filming process for a while. I started in improv and theater, and then I honestly, what I wanted to do, I wanted to like be on SNL. That was like my initial dream when I was like 15.
Right. So like early high school, late middle school, you got really into the performance thing.
Yeah. And so then I ended up going and doing my undergrad at Texas Lutheran University, and I went there on an acting scholarship. And so I just had to pretty much audition for every show that we had was like my requirement. But the program as a whole was like dramatic media. So it was a really like broad production program, basically. So we had to take classes in directing, editing, acting, screenwriting, literally like everything under the sun. You could like exclude like one or two things. And so I initially did not really like fuck with the directing classes, because I was very much just like, I didn't want to like think about anything else. And then I started to just like think about the, acting roles that were available. And it was, if there were any roles that, if you were like obviously gay, that automatically, you know, like limits what characters you can play so much. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm playing the same character over and over again. It's always this like supporting, like funny gay dude, or someone whose sexuality isn't really a thing. So it doesn't matter. So then I took the screenwriting class, and, I was like, oh wait, I'm actually like kind of good at this. And then I was like, oh, well, I could just like write my own roles. And so that was my initial thought, was I'll just write my own roles and then someone else can like direct me in that, whatever. And then I was like, oh, see, I really still don't like this because I'm just like giving it over to someone else. And I didn't want to like give what I was writing over to someone else.
Did you try that? Did you like try it once and not have a good experience with it, or?
No, not that. It was just, I think once I realized that it wasn't just about like, I think I realized that more of the writing and the acting and everything was more just that I was trying to like be like as like visible as possible and like what I was saying. And so I thought I had to like physically like be on screen in order to like feel like heard or seen or whatever. But then I kind of realized that that was not the case. I could still like do that through other people. And so I was like, let me just try this like one time. Let me try out the directing thing. And I didn't really try that out until I was doing my MFA in screenwriting, because I had kind of just been like, okay, well, I'm going to focus on screenwriting. And so then I was in my first semester of my screenwriting MFA at Chapman. And we have like a production class where all the screenwriters have to, write and direct, these 3-page short films. And so I like direct mine and, I was like, oh, maybe I like really want to like do this instead. And then that one I wrote, directed, starred in and edited it. And, I really was like totally happy with how it turned out. And actually my professor, our professor was a lot more interested in me as an actor than he was as a writer, in that short film. But I was just like, it's too much to really like focus on, you know, like, I think it's insane that there are people who can write, direct and star all in their own shit. That's like insane to me, but I'm way too like worried about everything else to do all of those things. And so then I finally just was like, okay, I'm going to retire the on-screen thing and just totally focus on, being behind the scenes because I want to like write and direct and edit all of my own stuff, and throwing in acting to that is just way too much. And I'm way too like self-conscious to be like doing that. And I think it's also really hard to edit yourself when it comes to acting as well.
So few people can do it. And it sounds like you were always drawn to the creative process and storytelling, and the deeper and deeper you got into it, sounds like the storytelling really took over for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't feel like, actually I was watching, I'm super obsessed with, The Lost Daughter that, just came out from Maggie Gyllenhaal. And, I was watching her talk about it, on like Stephen Colbert or something. And she was saying how when she was an actor, or I mean, you know, she's still an actor, but while she was just acting, she just kept feeling like she like wanted more and was like missing something. And then whenever she directed, she realized it, that she was like really always kind of like a director, and that she always wanted more out of acting. And she never felt fully, you know, fulfilled that way. And that's how I was, like, whether I was just writing or just acting or whatever, I never really felt fulfilled until I was actually physically like telling those stories from behind the scenes, as a director. And so this, making this film, was the first time that I felt like 100% like heard and connected to and seen. And I didn't have to, you know, be on screen to feel that way. Which was great, because that is just way too much stress for me.
Well, and hearing your story, you did so. I'm actually going to back up slightly. Obviously, you're acting. You showed a lot of acting talent in high school because you got that scholarship for undergrad. And then you left out the transition. So Chapman's in California. So in between, yes. In between. So you finished college, mm-hmm. mostly, I imagine, an acting-oriented degree.
Yeah.
And then you pursued an MFA in screenwriting.
Yeah, my undergrad was kind of, it was a like fairly like broad dramatic, it was considered dramatic media. So it was like both, it was like a film and theater hybrid. And so I was doing mostly acting, but then I really got into screenwriting a lot. But even then with the screenwriting, I was still acting in those things. So that was really my big focus while I was there. And so then I got to go and do my MFA in screenwriting, where I just focused on screenwriting. But even when I was just focusing on screenwriting, you know, a semester in, I was like, okay, I actually want to direct, so I'm kind of bored.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, I was just going to say that the fact that you, I mean, going for the MFA in screenwriting really shows just how dedicated you were to the creative process and like telling stories. And then it totally makes sense that, I mean, it's a real challenge, I think, to write a screenplay and not direct it in your mind.
Oh yeah. I don't know how people don't do that. And that was another thing that like would bother me in my MFA in screenwriting, is that you'll have professors who will tell you to stop directing in your script, because they can tell when you are directing. And I'll be like, okay, well, I'm writing this because I want to direct it. And they're like, oh, well, that's not like totally like feasible because you're like an unknown, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, well, they're not like, it's not like I'm about to like sell this script to fucking Marvel. Like, I can, if I'm going to write it, I'm going to write it the way I want to write it, not for someone else to do it, you know? And so that was like a big issue for me doing an MFA in screenwriting.
It's interesting because you make such a, that's like a competition of being realistic. Like the professors are being like old school realistic of like, if you over direct in your script, people won't want to buy it. But of course, okay, so I'm pretty old. So like, you know, 30 years ago, a lot of scripts were purchased because there were so many studios and every studio felt like they had to option 200-300 scripts a year or more. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, realistically, like they don't pick anything up anymore.
Yeah. So it's all just IP.
Yeah. It's all, yeah. They just buy companies that own, already own characters and stories. So yeah, when you're writing for yourself, it actually is more realistic to say, well, I'm not going to pitch this in some meeting and sell it. I'm most likely going to make it myself. So
yeah, that's exactly my thought. So.
Yeah.
Which that's not everyone's, you know, thought. Like most of the people that were in my MFA with me do not want to, you know, have no desire to direct. And so that was, you know, totally fine with them, I guess. But for me, I was like, that's not like the path that I want to take. So.
For sure. And I mean, I guess I have a bias. I understand your path more. I mean, actually, to tell the truth, to reveal a little something, like I went through in, you know, my God, the 90s. So 30 years ago, I went through the process of being a writer working for producers and directors. Mm-hmm. And it's completely unfulfilling. Like,
oh, yeah.
like I would tell people, like, I'm actually a plumber. And when the client says, can you put the toilet in the middle of the living room? I actually have to. I can't say, actually, the toilet belongs in the bathroom. Like, so, yeah, you, I completely identify with what you're saying.
Yeah. While I was doing my MFA, I had some people who asked me to write their, some of the directors and producers that would ask me to write their thesis films. And it was just like, I couldn't do it because it was these, you know, they have their own ideas of what the story is. And it's like, okay, well, this is technically your film. So I am just, you know, this like conduit, but having to like write things and that, you know, aren't good, or like certain aspects of the story that, you know, are not going to work, but they're like, well, that's like what I want, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh yeah, see, I can't do this. And that's one of the major things with like, if you're just focusing on screenwriting, you are being taught to be a like hired writer. And I have less than zero interest in that.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge to be creative yet subservient. It's really, and yeah, not to be complete ass towards the people in your program who asked you to write for them, but you almost want to turn to them, right, and say, well, why don't you write it? Like, is it just that you're too lazy to pump out a first draft, so you want me to pump out your first draft and then you can make it yours? Like, I don't know. But so you went through that, and you said, Did you get to direct stuff during that program?
I actually did this during the program. I did this during the first part of my second year. The first semester of my second year. I was just like, I'd been working on this script for like, what, I shot this at the end of 2019. So I've been working on it since 2017 when I graduated from my undergrad. And it was like nowhere near the same story originally. It was two guys and one night, still, but it was like all over the place. It went from like one apartment to like a conversation at like a party to heroes all over the place. And there were like more characters involved. And then I finally got it down to the two characters in just one night, but it was like double the length. And there was just like so much talking. And eventually I was like, okay, I'm just going to put this away for a while because I fucking hate the script right now, but I know there's something there eventually. And
you wrote it completely it was completely yours. It wasn't part of the program or school at all. This was your just like personal project. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, let me just like go kind of like live life for a little bit. And then we'll see what happens later on. And I kind of forgot about it for a while. And then once I started like, I don't know, just like experiencing more of like the, especially like being in LA, and kind of like experiencing what the, like, I don't know, life is like with all of this like completely new batch of like guys and everything. I was like,
yeah. And more of a scene, like,
yeah,
the bigger the city, it definitely changes social scenes, I think.
Yeah. And there were just like, there was a lot more life to live. And I felt like I finally kind of figured out what I wanted to say. And that was really the biggest part, was just like, I knew vaguely what I was like feeling whenever I started writing it, but I hadn't experienced it fully yet. So I needed a couple more years to really like get a little older and figure out what I was like really actually thinking, and feeling. And then whenever I finally narrowed that down, then the script just like came a lot easier, and it was like half the, I felt like I was saying way more in half the amount of pages. So it was just like a really like therapeutic experience, to write and everything. And then I just knew I had to figure out who I was going to have in it, that I was going to like actually be satisfied with. 'Cause you know, you see these people in your head, and obviously you, making this like little short film, you're not going to get the people that you really picture in your head, you know? So then I started the whole casting process, and it was, actually, I auditioned maybe like 100 guys, and, I ended up not liking anyone for, the role of not the main guy, but the other one, Chris. And I just didn't like anyone, 'cause that was the character who was written with my voice, and like my thoughts and everything. So I was probably just like a little bit more critical of that character. But I knew that my friend from undergrad, I had actually put him in a short, maybe 2 years before that. And he was like the only person I'd met who could like handle, like who knew with like the jokes and stuff, everyone would play them as jokes. And I was like, no, like I know like what he's saying may be kind of insane sounding, but he's like dead ass serious, and no one would play it that way. They would just play it all as like jokes. And I was like, this is not a Ryan Murphy show. And he just like got it. And so I was like, whatever, I'm just going to fly him in from Austin. I'd rather do that than have to like use someone that I'm having to like constantly like readjust nonstop. And then the other character, he said one line and he said the opening line in the script, and I like immediately was like, okay, well, it's gonna be him. And all he did was say like, hi, my name's Jason, or something. I think that's like the opening line, is him saying that, or that's his opening line. That's as soon as he said that, I was like, oh, well, it's gonna be him. And that was it. He ended up being like perfect. I can't imagine anyone else playing it now.
He is perfect, and I totally get everything you just said. Because your main character, he pretty much, so his emotional confidence in a way is what completely changes the other character. Like the other character really grows through this experience, and he's really the emotional hub of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say, so you see yourself in him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the one who I was like, really like expressing all my shit through, was him, because originally he was the main character. In all the other drafts, he was the main character. But then I thought, I think this will probably be better overall and also better for me to see this from the other perspective, and bring myself, my views in, especially because I think, you know, in any story, it's like a little more interesting if, the like a little bit more wild one comes in and shakes it up as opposed to the other way around. And so I felt like it kind of like starting a little bit like, you know, slower and whatnot. And then him coming in and being like, oh, hey, like, if you try to piss on me, I'm going to call the cops. And like taking his clothes off and he's in a jock strap. And so I felt like that would be like a much more interesting entrance and a much better way to like, kind of like really like hit things off than just because originally it was like his character and he was just like hooking up with all these guys. And he was, you know, like over it or whatever. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take all of this out. Plus I just didn't want to deal with other more characters. And so, yeah, I just, once I flipped it and kind of tried to make it more about the other guy, it also for some reason got easier for me, to not try to think maybe it was just like less pressure to, if I made the character who was mostly about, not the one that was, you know, based on myself.
And, you know, your instincts were so great because we know everything that, because the story is so, I think I had the adjective before, but like, because it's sincere and just so true to life, like we know their pasts. Like you don't, we didn't have to see the series of Grindr hookups to know what happened before these two ended up in a room together. Like it's all there. It's all there in the dialogue as well as just what we know.
Yeah. I was trying to trust the audience. Cause I just, I was like, I do not want to spoon feed this, to everyone. I want to leave it a little bit up to them. I was like, they'll figure it out.
And most do. Most do.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to say, your cat, like you said, you bothered to bring someone you knew from Texas to California to shoot this. I mean, the acting is just so superb. It really.
That's also, that's like my favorite. That's one of my favorite things, is just working with actors. And I think coming from a background and knowing what it's like to be on that side of it, and, you know, when I'm asking them to be like incredibly like both emotionally and physically vulnerable, like the entire time, or like barely wearing clothes, like most of the film. And while they're also having to like bare their souls, whether they themselves feel that way or not, it's still incredibly like, it can be so awkward to sit there and say, you know, these really emotional things in front of people. Also though, there's such a small crew and we were literally just in that bedroom the whole time. So there wasn't room for people anyway. So I was like, well, like 70% of this film is going to be like a closed set. So it was literally just like the two actors, me, the DP, a gaffer, and the sound. There were like, it was like four crews and the four people on crew and two actors pretty much in the room the whole time. So it was just such a like intimate setting the whole time. And I really wanted to just actually, I didn't even let them meet each other until when we shot their first actual interaction. As soon as Jordan, the one who plays the main character, as soon as he got there, I sent Colin, the other actor, outside on the balcony of the apartment. And I was like, okay, you're going to like hang out here and you're going to hang out in the bedroom and y'all are literally not going to meet each other. And we shot Jordan's opening stuff first and did all of that, and then whenever they finally like met, that's like them actually like meeting for the first time on camera. I really wanted to get that because I was like, well, they're really they're meeting for the first time. It's going to be super awkward in here. So they're about to go through the same experience. Yeah. I didn't have them interact with each other whatsoever. Not through like text, email, in person, anything. I wanted to go full on method there.
Yeah. What's fascinating there is that you got this amazing performance and amazing chemistry between your two characters. Both are fantastic. And so obviously they didn't rehearse. Like everything is, you created a situation, as a director, you created the environment for amazing performances without rehearsal.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like rehearsal. I know some people are very like, they want to rehearse it like 5-6 times, whatever. I don't like it. I want to see what comes. I want your like first instinct to be, I want to see it, on camera. You never know what you're going to get. And I don't want to miss anything. And I feel like if you're rehearsing, there's going to be little things that you're going to lose, in the process. And, I didn't want to lose anything. I mean, Colin kind of rehearsed with me a little bit, with his lines, just more of like line readings on, specific, like on the jokes and whatnot. You know, like on the, parts when he says, what is it about Ann Coulter? He makes the Ann Coulter joke that, is like, he's saying it like after this, like long monologue, him like burying his soul. Yeah, just like those like random, like little joke line readings that are always like in these like serious places. We kind of rehearsed those a little bit, just to get the readings down, but that was really it. Didn't rehearse anything with Jordan. But he's like a very, like, he's like constantly auditioning, and, he's like a very, very, very professional. So I knew that he would like come with his shit together, and he did. I really honestly didn't have to do a ton with him throughout the process. Just like really more like, oh, hey, can we just like make that a little like smaller? That was really like the most I really had to do with him. He was just so like in tune with that character. It was really, really great to watch.
And I have to say, I think your choices were excellent, because the film and the story itself is so immediate and so raw in a way. Like you shoot it in a raw way, so you kept the performances a little raw, because it all, you know, obviously, you know, Downton Abbey type dialogue needs to be rehearsed and perfected, but
yeah.
But the rawness, it fits the look of the film, it fits the story of the film. It really just brings it all together. Like you knew instinctively what kind of performance you needed.
Yeah, it was, I knew that I wanted to, just sit the camera on them and just kind of like, let it happen, see what happens. I didn't want to cut really like at all. I think every single scene is a one take until the very last scene is the only reverse shot in the whole thing. I just wanted to sit the camera, watch what happens. Just kind of be like a little bit of a fly on the wall. And I just really did not want to take anyone out of the moment ever. And then I ended up having to kind of do when I wrote it, it was completely linear. The kind of like cutaways, to them throughout the night, I originally had just happening in a linear way, but whenever I was editing it, I decided to switch it because there would just be like little moments. Like I would love every single thing in one, but because of the way that I shot it with it being all one takes, I would love every single thing except for like one moment. And I was like, okay, so if I want to use this take, I have to either use this take fully, or I have to figure out how to get around the little things that I don't like. So like there's one moment whenever Colin's character is having the main little like monologue where he says the title and everything. And there's one little moment where when he like puts his hand he puts his hand in the other actor's hair, and he did it like a little awkwardly. And I was like, oh, that does not like ring true to me. And then there was like another little moment where, the other actor did something like a little weird, and there were just like little moments, a couple of like little moments. And so I was like, okay, so how can I get around this? And so that's how I came up with the idea to bring all of those, in between moments into the actual conversations and just kind of like show them like whatever they're talking about. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have them talking about this, and then we're going to see something related to that, you know, in a little cutaway. And so I was able to put those cutaways in the moments that I didn't like as much. And so then I was like, okay, well, once I've done this once or twice, I have to kind of do it a little bit throughout. So I just ended up taking all those in-between moments and putting them throughout the conversations, to kind of also like a little bit show, where they're at in that moment or what they could be thinking about, what they could be referencing, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so it ended up making the film shorter. So that was nice. I'm glad that it ended up happening that way, 'cause I like it a lot more this way, than would it have been totally, linear. But that's one of the important parts of the edit, is that you can end up telling a completely different story or a very different version of that story. And that's what happened. I just had to kind of maneuver, because maybe every decision that you make, you know, it's like a little domino effect. And so my decision to shoot them in one takes, then I had to deal with the other issues that came with that. But it all worked out. I was glad with what happened.
Yeah, no, you did a fantastic edit. You know, it's interesting. I'll share with you. So, a friend and board member of the festival was actually over at my home and said, hey, show me something great. So I threw on Those People, because I think I'd seen it maybe either earlier that day or the day before. And I was like, you should watch this. And we actually had a debate of sorts. And of course, both sides are right of whether it was linear or not, because we actually, as an audience member, like we don't like all the intimate moments in between dialogue could have been moments in between dialogue, or it could be, you know, flash forward, but either way, it just sort of carried the story along. And we actually disagreed. she and I disagreed on, on a couple of things. We both loved the film, but, there's actually enough to it for audience members to really just, you know, art is always in being interpreted by the viewer.
Yeah, I was like, that's one of the things also with it, is that there are moments in there that I see as like moments that are flashes forward, and some that I see that are backwards. Some could even be like little in between of that conversation, maybe. But yeah, that's just another thing that's really open to interpretation. But I definitely saw it as a way to make it nonlinear and, you know, just give it a little spice up.
And to dial back to something you said earlier too, the fly on the wall aspect, I think that's one of the things I love most about it is, I think I've used the word raw, but it's also just, besides being raw and sincere, I do feel like I'm witnessing real moments between human beings. You know, I do feel like that fly on the wall when I watch a film, and I do feel like I'm watching, you know, it has such a, I don't know, I just think there's a lot of integrity to it. And so your decision to shoot all dialogue as a one-er, I think absolutely forces the audience or creates a situation where the audience is like, wow, I am watching two people fall for each other, like in a very real way. And I kind of love how you condense it all into one evening.
Yeah, it went on to the film shortage site for a couple of weeks or whatever, a couple months ago, and they asked for like a tagline or whatever. And I was like, oh wow, I haven't like thought about that. And I ended up coming up with, I was talking about it and I was like, oh, well, you know, I guess it's kind of like a Grindr fairy tale. And then thinking about it, I was like, oh my gosh, I guess that is kind of like why I made it in a way. Was it's like, I've had so many of these experiences and they always end so like shitty. And so it was like a way of me being like, okay, well, if what would like my ideal scenario be, of how one of these experiences would actually go. And that's what I ended up, writing was basically just like my ideal situation of how this would go. And give those characters a different ending. Cause originally I had a different ending. Originally I had him leave, and that was it. So then I was like, now it's like, I actually had someone ask me, they were like, wait, is he there or no? And I was like, no, he's there. You know, you just like see the little, his little look, at the end, and that's just him looking at him. And I have him, there is footage of him actually like walking in with like coffee. But I cut that out because I didn't want that either. I wanted it to like be as subtle as possible. And maybe even have people debate whether or not, he's there. But he is there. He does show up right at the very last second and walk into the room. But I just kind of cut it like right before he actually steps into frame, like a millisecond before he steps into frame.
And I was going to say, as far as taglines go, by the time you were at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, you gave us the tagline, a love story, but not.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But actually it really is a love story.
Yeah. I said a love story, but not, because I want to be like realistic in that they, you know, aren't like in love at the end, but it is the structure of one, and it is them falling for each other. But we don't really know what's going to happen from now on. Whereas like, you know, in a full, like romantic comedy, you know, that they're going to fall in love 3/4 of the way in, blah, 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 blah. So I wanted to be like, okay, well, they're not like in love yet, but they're, you know, they're on a path to something that could be good.
For sure. Yeah, obviously I despise the term meet cute, but like, this is your meet real.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like and there's a minute. And because it's written so well and acted so well and directed so well, I would actually be upset if you told me, yeah, I see them as never seeing each other again. I'd be like, no, don't say that. I really,
yeah,
I
no,
feel I, like I've watched the beginning of something real.
Yeah. Yeah. That is definitely what I hope. I wanted to be like, okay, let's see what everybody thinks at the end. And I hope that, you know, you think that it's the start of something that could, you know, be good and real. So I'm glad that you say that.
Well, you know, I'm also just a bit of a romantic anyway. I think even though I'm a very realistic person, I mean, but you know, the connection that is there. So, you know, Lord knows
I also
face 1,000 things that get in the way of love, but the foundation has happened.
That's also why I think it's crazy that that my actress had never met before. Because I, you know, I was like, you really, it's hard to, you know, like create, you can't really like create chemistry between actors. You know, it's just, they're going to have it or they're not. Or, you know, some actors are just not as like willing to get in there with it. And they were both like entirely just like totally throwing themselves in there. And, there were times where I was like, oh, are they going to be cool? Are they going to be weird? Is this going to like get weird at any point? As it, you know, progresses on, we shot it almost chronologically. I think almost everything, except we had to use a little crane at one point, for a couple scenes. But other than that, everything else went totally in order. Cause I wanted it to kind of, you know, build as it would, throughout the night, which, you know, normally you don't ever get to shoot chronologically, but when you're in like such a contained little setting of just one bedroom the whole time and one night, which also, yeah, we shot it in one night, and it happens over one night, and we shot it pretty much almost chronologically. So it was kind of cool to experience that, in that way, because you just never get to do that.
For those listening, Ryan told me before we started recording that, Jordan was flying in from Texas and the flight got delayed over a day.
Yeah. Oh, Colin. Yeah. Colin was, he was flying in from Texas, and the flight got delayed like 36 hours. And so instead of having a whole weekend to do everything, we ended up having 10 hours, because we could only shoot at night, and he had to be back at LAX at like 9 a.m. And so we shot from like 6 to 6 or 7 to 7, something crazy like that. Or not even fully, I guess it was honestly probably like 6 or 7 to 4 or 5 a.m. And that was all the time that we had. But luckily, because I'd already decided to shoot everything, all of the dialogue in one takes and everything, that ended up working out. So I didn't really have to change a ton. We would have just had a lot more time to really like think about everything. So I'm also kind of glad that that happened, because it could have ended up being like way overthought, had we had 3 days to shoot it.
Well, and my goodness, your actors totally delivered the groceries, so to speak, because if there were line reading troubles and stuff, if there were lines forgotten, if they didn't stay in the moment, like those oneers could have shot you in the foot. A minute into, well, I guess there's no real long conversation, but yeah, if people were tripping on lines and having trouble remembering what to say, oneers, ooh, nowhere to go.
Yeah. And all of the longer lines all kind of fell on Colin, because he is the one kind of just like constantly like being, he's the oversharer, so all of that kind of like fell on him, and he's the one who had just gotten in at like 1 a.m, barely had sleep, then had to immediately start going over like lines with me and figuring everything out. And then knew that he was going to get no sleep again the following morning and just had to pretty much go straight to the airport. So I was like, oh God, this poor guy.
But he, thankfully when you're young, you can pull that kind of crap off. Boy, let me tell you. I remember doing all nighters in the early 20s. It's doable.
Yep.
But it's actually not doable. Like a couple decades later, you're like, no, sleep is more important. Sorry.
Right. Even now, like heading into my like late 20s, I'm like, oh my God, I need 10 hours. Give me 10 hours or I'm dead.
A good night's sleep is like, it's very sobering when you realize, wow, I just passed up fun because sleep is more important to me. All right. So you had the one night shoot, and then, was it a fairly quick edit? Did the edit sounds like you found what you were looking for and found the techniques.
Yeah. Because I'm pretty much when I'm writing, I'm pretty much like writing, directing, and editing all at the same time. I'm like kind of directing, editing it in my head, simultaneously. But especially with this, considering it was so many one takes and everything, there wasn't really a ton to think about at first until I started to notice like the little moments that I didn't like as much. And then whenever I figured out, you know, the tactic to kind of make it not so linear and everything, that really like cleared it up. But it was a pretty quick edit. And then I lost the file. And there were still like a couple of little things that I wanted to fix in the edit. And I had come back to Texas because of COVID. And I was just like, I do not have the strength in me to go back through and edit all of this, but I had the file. I still had like a cut of it. The most recent cut, I still had it like as a private Vimeo video. And so I, texted my roommate from, LA, and I was like, and he's an editor. And I was like, I do not have the strength to go back through and do this again. If I pay you, will you just take this, this cut that I have and just like recreate it? Cause I still have all the files. And so I just sent him my hard drive and had him, go back through and just like recreate my edit, and fix a couple little things. Like there was a, what was it? There was a light. There was a light in a reflection in one of the shots. And I was like, oh my God. And I really wanted to use that shot. And so I had him, you know, like get rid of, Photoshop that out and, do a couple little things. But yeah, so he ended up going back and like redoing the edit for me because I was just like, I can't redo this. This was painful. So it ended up being a little bit difficult just in that sense, because I have no idea how the file got lost, but luckily I had the actual, you know, physical copy of the film, to go back from. And I still had all of the files, on my hard drive, but for some reason, the actual, premiere, timeline and everything was gone.
Crazy. Well, I'm glad you had someone who could help you out in that moment. 'Cause who knows, you might have, maybe 6 months later, you could have jumped back in and recut it, but that would have been really hard. I'm glad there was someone who could rebuild it for you.
Yeah, I was just like, I do not have the emotional strength to go back in and redo this. And I hate editing audio. It's just the most annoying experience, the most annoying thing ever. And there is one part in the film that still drives me insane. One moment of audio where he is, when he's talking in the closet, and we had the audio of him in the closet, and somehow that's the only audio file that got corrupted. So we had to use one that was like all like close up in it. I don't know. It sounds like voiceover. It sounds like he's like voicing it over instead. And that's what we had to use. And so that every time I literally, when I watch the film back, I skip through that scene because it makes me so mad that, I had to use that audio. Luckily it's like a very short, it's one of like the shortest scenes. But that part just, oh my God, drives me insane. And I sent it to one of my friends and I was like, how obvious is it? And he was like, can you like redo that audio? I was like, it's fine.
Well, I don't know how reassuring it would be coming from me, but as someone who's seen the film many times, including once on a nice 25-foot screen with an audience, I think you pull us in to the story and in with the characters so much. I didn't notice I didn't notice it at all. If you had said, hey, is there any moment when you would remember that voiceover moment? I'd be like, there's no voiceover in this.
It was when he was in the closet and he says like, you look like a closeted Republican's wet dream.
I love that line, by the way. Was that was all written?
Yeah. Yeah. That part, it's the audio, it sounds like voiced over. And I was like, no, and I love that line and it's in the audios, but it was okay.
So funny. 'Cause I picture them together when that line's delivered. Interesting. So it all mashes up in the head.
But yeah, it's when he's like, cause he's like rummaging through his closet. We happened to have the audio in the closet for one take, just to make sure that we got it as clear as possible on him. And then we had it kind of away from him. And the one that was away from him obviously sounded more realistic because it's supposed to be from the other character's point of view. But when that audio file got corrupted, we had to use the one that was right up there with him. So it just sounded like too close to him.
And so you had the casting challenge too, of not just actors who could portray the characters, but I mean, you had a physical description of sorts, because he really is a Republican's wet dream. Like,
yeah, he had to look exactly like that.
Yeah. And then the other guy definitely looks like the kind of guy that a Republican looks like and goes, oh, look at me. He's one of those people.
Yeah. Yeah, and like literally Jordan is from Arkansas, like born and raised on like a ranch in Arkansas. And he's, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed. He was in like a Lifetime movie as like a super like douchey like jock or something like that, you know. And when I saw his reel, he was like a douchey jock or like a douchey guy in the army. And it was kind of like, it was like clear that he was like being like typecast. And so I almost didn't have him audition. But I was like, oh, you know what? Maybe he's like, maybe this is what he's really interested in doing, but he's just, you know, getting typecast all the time. And that's, you know, what it turned out.
So interesting that it's his look is determining. Obviously, everyone's look determines what roles they get, but his look is pushing him into a very tight niche of like a cisgendered patriarchal male. Like,
yeah, and he's so good. And I was like, I don't want him to have to, you know, feel like he's like stuck in this. And then whenever I actually had him audition, I was like, oh wow, he should not be stuck playing like douchey jocks only.
for sure. Well, it also sounds like the film that was in your mind when you were writing sounds like while you were on the set and then doing the edit, like you could see that film was there. Like you got what you were, you got exactly what you were after.
Yeah. I could tell while we were shooting, I was like, okay, I can tell that we're getting the performances, and my DP Ben, he was also in the MFA screenwriting program with me. But he's like a really great DP. And was really, he knew exactly what I wanted. And he has not like totally similar taste, but like very close to. He's really experimental. He has like some like batshit insane, like experimental films. So I wasn't like worried about, I knew he would not try to be like super conventional with anything. And he would be totally down to just like sit and watch people, or he wasn't going to be like, oh, should we like make sure that we get all the coverage on both people and singles and blah, blah, blah. I knew I wasn't going to have to like deal with that. Cause sometimes you can get with a DP and they're very like, you know, sometimes they can be a little controlling with it because they want to make sure that everything is, you know, covered in the most like conventional ways. Cause that's, you know, that's what we're taught a lot of the time. I mean, that's what we were taught. And he was very much not that. He was like, but he was also great at, he would have to tell me sometimes like, the shot's not going to work, or this shot isn't going to work because of this, blah, blah, blah. And I could trust him to know that. Cause there are definitely certain times where I'm like, can we do this shot? Is this shot going to edit okay with this shot? That stuff still kind of like trips me up a little bit. So I will never be a DP. And like, even though I edit my own stuff, I still sometimes have to be like, wait, is that edit going to work? And I have to like ask my DP because they always know. Actually, I think pretty much everything that I've done in the last few years, he's shot. So we also had like a good trust with each other because we'd worked with each other in his film that he had done for our class I was in. And then he shot my stuff that I had done for his, for the class. And then he shot something else that I was in. So we'd like worked together a million times. So that's also just super important, is the relationship with the DP. I don't know how people work with like total strangers as their DPs.
I mean, it's very much like casting an actor in a way, because you can't ask a DP to not be themselves. Like an actor, the performance an actor is going to give you, I mean, great actors can take direction and completely change, but a DP who doesn't have like experimental instincts and is willing to take risks just can't work with you if you're going to say, no, I want to do this in like a challenging way. And I want it to look more, it's not like you got these set pieces that look so polished that it'll go on a DP's reel, you know?
I think we both knew that we wanted it to be like really like raw and not like, I was like, I don't want to use like a red and, you know, I want it to not be like, it's clear that we, you know, we're like, oh, hey, let's go get an Alexa and make this as like perfect looking as possible. I was like, I am totally down with some camera shake and, you know, I want it to just look real and like we're just sitting there with them, not like we're watching like some massive like Avatar movie where it's like so clear that you're like why is this better than my vision? Because I just didn't feel right.
It's interesting because the human intimacy that you're portraying, there's something that's not intimate about those super sharp, super clear, shot films. Like it is interesting. Yeah, I saw a film recently that takes place in England during women's liberation, and it was so clean and Hollywood looking that it actually lacked the grit that the story had and the performances had.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite movies, Fish Tank by Andrea Arnold. I was watching, I just like watching what she does in her short film, won the Oscar for best short back in, like, I don't know, 2005, 2006, something like that. And if you go and watch that, it is very much like she's just like following these people around with the camera, and like anyone could just be following them around. And I was like, oh, that is like the kind of thing that I want. It's not like now, if the last like few years, when I've like seen any Oscar winners, or like people with short films specifically, they're very high budget, looking and whatnot. And, while that's obviously great, some people are super into that. I think that works for certain stories, but for this kind of story, that was not going to make sense to me. I didn't want to spend $900 a day on a camera rental anyway, but yeah. And I mean, I would have loved to, I would shoot everything on film if I could. The first thing that I wrote while I was doing my, the second thing that I wrote while I was doing my MFA at Chapman, we have to, partner with the directors, and we write an 8-page script and they direct it. Me and one of the directors co-wrote, a short, and, he ended up shooting it on 16mm. And, when that whole process was going on, I was immediately like, oh God, I'm just going to want to shoot everything on 16mm. And then like all of my favorite movies are always shot on film, but it's just so much more expensive when you're doing it when you're doing shorts. When it comes to like features, it kind of like evens out anyway, but with shorts, it's hard. But my next short, I have to shoot it on film. There's just no way that I can shoot it on digital. So,
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know what they are, but I mean, at this point, there's these filters that,
yes,
adding an element of film grain to digital, it is actually almost becoming invisible. Like it is,
yep,
more possible than it's ever been.
Yep. There's Kelly Reichardt's First Cow. When I watched it, I thought she shot it on film because she shoots everything on 16mm. And then I saw an interview with her and they were like, blah, blah, blah. So you shot this one on film too. And she was like, no, we didn't. She's like, I'm glad you saw it. So we shot it on Alexa and they just, you know, messed with it because they didn't have the budget, to shoot this one on film. And it looks like it's shot on film. I thought it was shot on film until she said that it wasn't. And I've seen people have these, they're called like LUTs or something like that, where they can put it over it. There's like, I put like little bits of grain over this one just to kind of try to bring down the resolution even just like a little bit more. I put a little bit of a grain on it. But yeah, I really wish I could shoot everything on 16. But yeah, it's such a better look to me.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful stuff. But yeah, Lord knows those lab costs get high.
Oh, yeah.
And the extra time involved too. And then
yep,
there's even more cost down the road when you've got to cut the negative and then transfer back to video because everything has to end up,
yep,
digitized anyway. It's a rigmarole that people, I think, are unaware of now. I mean, not that many people have even tried shooting on film at this point.
Yep. Yeah. I really wish. That's another one, The Lost Daughter. I'm still super obsessed with it right now because I've just watched it. Saw Maggie Gyllenhaal talking about how she really wanted to shoot it on film and they didn't have the budget. I was watching it the whole time I was watching it, I was like, oh man, you can tell that they wanted this to be on film, and it would have been so, so great to see this on film. So I was glad that, Pablo Larraín got to shoot Spencer on 16 millimeter, because I can't imagine that having been shot digitally at all. So when I see the directors still get to do it sometimes, I'm like, oh, at least it's still a possibility.
For sure. For sure. All right. Well, okay. So now the timeline, I know that you shot the film towards the end of 2019.
Yeah.
When life was what we used to call normal. And yes. And then you held tight during COVID and didn't do a lot of festivals, I guess. You did do the Portage thing for a bit.
Yeah.
And then Sherman Oaks Film Festival was a theatrical premiere?
Yes. Cool. Yeah,
geez, so lucky.
Yeah, I shot it in October of 2019, finished the edit right before COVID, like February of 2020. I like finalized the initial edit before I had to have it recut. And then I was like, okay, well, all these festivals are going virtual, so I'm not going to deal with that. And then I was like, okay, now we're like getting to 2021 and they're still virtual. And so I just like kept holding out. And then finally around whenever I came across, I think I was looking for specifically for art house selections. And, so then I came across Sherman Oaks and I was like, okay, it says it's going to be in person and it's like 10 minutes from my apartment. So I was like, okay, cool.
I didn't know you were a hometown filmmaker. I guess I should check addresses, but yeah, I knew you were LA area, but I didn't know you were actually like 10 minutes from where we screen.
Yep. Right on I've lived like 2 minutes from the Galleria.
Oh shit. I used to live across the street from the Galleria. I used to walk out of my apartment building and see P.F. Chang's.
Oh, wow. Oh yeah. 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 I was like, yeah, I lived like 2 minutes from there. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then the film shortage thing as well. And then I was just kind of like, okay, well, now I'm kind of like, I've been with this film for like 2 years now. So it's just like, that's going to be it. You know, I'm just going to move on to the next one. I missed out on, you know, whatever, because of COVID. But I was like, I'm not going to like start a whole other round of like festival. I'm not going to like try to, you know, do a whole other year of like festival stuff this many years later, which a lot of festivals are, they open theirs up to 2019, 2020, 2021. Like if you shot any of those 3 years because of COVID, they're open to that. But I was like, I don't really want to have to like go through a whole year with a film that I've already been like sitting with for this long. Even though I would love to, but I was like, I just kind of want to like move on at this point.
Yeah. And it's personal experience, right? Like the festival circuit is such an interesting beast nowadays. Like it's really what the filmmaker wants to get out of it. Like everyone gets something different out of their festival run. And Lord knows the process of, it's funny when you talk about the years as a festival programmer, I happen to be involved in two festivals that we've never had any rule about what year something was shot. Like, if you submit it and it's good, it's in. If every once in a while, I will notice the date at the end is old. But then I've been like, wait, I am aware of films that will like throw a year at the end of their film and on their IMDb, but then like it gets stuck for like a year or two. And so then you have a film that is actually new for 2021 that says 2019 on it. And
yeah.
So I don't really care about these years.
Yeah. Some festivals are very specific. They're like, oh, it can't have been shot before like this day of this month of this year. Which is very weird to me, but yeah. So I was like, I don't really want to have to like contend with that. So.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, so what do you have planned next?
Probably the next short that I want to shoot that I've been working on recently is a period piece. And I know where I want to shoot it in LA, but it's a much bigger, it's still just two characters, one location, but will cost me probably like 10 times what this one cost me. And have to, like I said, I have to shoot this one on 16 millimeter film because it's set in the early 1900s. And it's about a woman who died in her family home. I mean, you don't really like get to find out why. And so she's a ghost that's been there for like 100 years. And this woman comes running in, trying to get away from her wedding. She comes running in her wedding dress and she's like, she doesn't want to get married. She thinks that this place is vacant, but actually there's this like ghost that's been living here for 100 years. And they spend that like day and night, kind of, getting to know each other in a sense. And it's kind of a, horror-ish, ghost story. So it's still kind of going to be like, I'm trying to do like a little like trilogy of shorts about like connection. And so I got to do that one. It was very, very small and contained in that like one bedroom. So now I want to get this one where it's still two characters over the course of like 24 hours, but it's in a like Victorian, a really like big Victorian, not mansion, but pretty close to it. House. It'll be interesting because it's like, this one was about connection and like not being able to connect, but it's like him kind of like being in his own way. And then this one, like she literally like physically can't connect because she's a fucking ghost. But the other woman does not know that. And it becomes a little, sinister-ish, from this woman's side, from the ghost side. Because she does not want this woman to leave.
Right, right.
She's been alone for 100 years.
If I'm going to share something, this might be me being silly, but if when you get to that, I have a hot tip from a filmmaker who set something in the Victorian era, which is she told me that she went to one of the comic book conventions and found cosplayers, and there were all these really talented cosplayers who were the seamstresses for her film. Like they were like, I would love to make a Victorian costume. I'll do it for free. Like, cause these people, their passion is costuming,
right?
They do it just for fun. And so she actually got free wardrobe for a Victorian era horror film from cosplayers.
Hey, that was literally in, the Hawkeye TV series. They got LARPers to make their new little superhero suits.
Really? I haven't watched
it. Yep. Yep, they get LARPers to do it.
That's so funny. It makes perfect sense.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, well, that sounds cool. Anything else you want to add before we wind it up?
I think right now is just kind of like the point where I feel like I'm having to really fully like throw myself into the script writing process and trying to figure out which feature I really want to like focus on, trying to get going as my like debut feature, and figuring all of that out. And, you know, do I want to go the like kind of Barry Jenkins route where he did a very, very small contained like $10,000-$15,000 feature, but got him into festivals, got him, some notice and everything. Or, you know, do I want to try to continue to stick out the festival circuit or trying to find someone who, you know, has access to a lot more money and whatnot? So I think that's kind of where I'm at right now, trying to have to really make that decision on what the best entryway is.
It is the curse of the creative. The balance between art and money.
Yep.
Just recently, a director I really like and respect who is on the indie circuit, he's had two films at our festival over the last 6 years, and he was complaining about something on Facebook. And I said, look, this goes all the way back to Van Gogh. It's from the beginning, artists have never really had a halfway decent way to eat and clothe and house themselves and pursue their art. It's just such a son of a bitch situation.
Yep.
It really is. But
we'll figure it out somehow.
You know, we're, As a fan of the arts, I can say, you know, and someone who, it's funny, I get called a curator nowadays as a festival programmer. Like, I could not express to you my gratitude that there's people like yourself still making art for us to all enjoy. And son of a bitch, someday I'm going to figure out a way to like say, hey, and now here's how you can make some money at it too.
Yep. But that is also the curse, is that that sadly is not what we care about most.
It's, yeah. And we tried with this Amazon TV series, and it's wonderful to get more eyeballs on the work. But, yeah, even when we were up around 10,000 unique viewers in a week, it ended up being $21 of streaming royalty to be divided, by the way, among 75 filmmakers. So,
right.
So more people than you could ever wish for watching completely independent short films. And there's just there's no way to get audiences to actually pay.
Yep.
It's tough. Maybe someday. My heart goes out to everyone.
Yeah, well, at least there's someone trying.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, is there a website or anything if people are interested in you or those people, like to learn more or follow you?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me on my socials. My socials are just That's So Ryan with 2 S's and 3 N's. And that's pretty much where I post
everything.
3 N's
at the end?
Yeah, 3 N's at the end. Someone else had the 1 S. Someone else had the 2 N's. Everything. I had to get creative.
Hey, as long as you have the same one everywhere, you're good, right?
Yes. Yep.
All right. Cool. That's So Ryan. So THATSSORYANNN.
Yes.
Cool. All right. If I can, I will remember to add that to the post of this, so it'll be in the what do you call it? Show notes. I think people call them show notes. I don't know all these podcast terms. Anyway, podcasting has changed so much in the 3 years I've been doing this. But all right, cool. Well, now I will go on a brief spiel for everyone to hear. First, I believe I am correct that the next season of the Discovery Indie Film TV series will have those people in it.
Yes.
Which is, so everyone who heard about it, if you haven't seen it, I certainly hope you look forward to seeing it. And when the time comes, it'll just be on Amazon Prime Video. So you just go to Prime Video anywhere and search for Discover Indie Film and check out that. By then, there'll be 5 seasons. You can learn more about the TV series and the podcast if you go to discoverindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's always at DIFWINS. Of course, just like you had to add N's to get your Instagram, we couldn't get any form of it was just kind of a funny and filmmakers voted on, which I had a bunch of people like, and DIFWINS ended up being the winner, which is kind of funny. But so that's that. And those people was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2021, which was in the theaters. I think we're going to be in the theaters from now on. I think we're good.
Yeah,
I think these vaccine requirements and mask requirements get us through whatever waves come our way. If you want to learn about that festival that takes place every November, it's ShermanOaksFF.com. And on social media, it's at ShermanOaksFF. And coincidentally, or not coincidentally, we have a second festival. There's a sister festival to Sherman Oaks called Film Invasion Los Angeles. Same theater, same team. That's every June. So that's FilmInvasionLA.com. And on social media, it's at FilmInvasionLA. Oh, and the thing I forgot to ask people to do, if you're hearing this, give a review, give 5 stars, give the podcast a thumbs up or 5 stars wherever you're listening to it. Subscribe, go to Amazon.com and search for the Discover Indie Film TV series on Prime Video. Why don't you give it 5 stars? Be nice. Kindness is of short supply sometimes. So give everything 5 stars. And thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone who's listening.